Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Back for another 2 hours, we're going to talk about some of the things that matter most. How about quick fixes for a bad mood? And no, I'm not talking about substances here. I'm not even talking about exercise. I'm talking about a new study that's out that will teach us something better than reaching for a dish of ice cream or watching our favorite comedy. We'll talk to Dr. Gregory Popcheck about it, but there's, scientific evidence that shows us there's better ways to fix our moods. A story from the Cold War that many people have not heard is the story of Cardinal Joseph Mindszenty. In February, Pope Francis announced that Cardinal Mindszenty had been declared venerable. This was a remarkable man who suffered mightily for the faith. He was the Prince Primate of Hungary. He was faithful when underwent torture for the church, but had his titles removed by Pope Paul VI for a period of time. We're going to talk with Paul Kengor about why that was the case and how the church treated this heroic figure and how the church is now going back to recognize his achievements. For the second straight year, transgender athletes took first and second place at the Connecticut Girls State Track Championships. Parents and others have tried to point out the obvious unfair advantages these athletes have. They're being painted as bigots. It's just another example of the state of the conversation in our culture when it comes to gender and sexual identity. We'll talk about the theology of the body for children with Dr. Andrew Sodergren. We'll also take a look at the transhumanist movement in America and around the world, which is interested in merging artificial and natural intelligence. Stay with me. Right now, it's the news.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. For Tuesday, May 14th, it's the Feast of St. Matthias. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The worst outbreak of violence since the deadly Easter bombings has Sri Lanka under a nationwide curfew. At least one man was killed in attacks on mosque and a Muslim-owned business yesterday. The violence was sparked over the weekend when Christians viewed a social media post by a Muslim man as a threat. Sri Lanka's prime minister called for calm yesterday, saying the violence was interfering with the investigation of the Easter Sunday bombings. Previous curfews since the bombings were limited to specific areas near the capital of Colombo. Tiger Woods is speaking out today about being sued for the death of an employee at a restaurant he owns in Jupiter, Florida.
We're all very sad that Nick passed away. It was a terrible night, a terrible ending, and we feel bad for him and his entire family.
The parents of 24-year-old Nicholas Immisberger are suing the Woods restaurant and Woods himself after their son drank alcohol there just before he was killed in a single car accident in December. The lawsuit says Immisberger's blood alcohol level was 2.56, more than three times the legal limit in Florida. The suit alleges that Woods and other employees knew Immisberger had a drinking problem, but would regularly overserve him during and after his shifts. Five people are dead and 10 injured after two float planes crashed in southeastern Alaska.
NTSB is launching a go team to investigate what appears to be a mid-air collision of two aircraft near Ketchikan, Alaska.
NTSB member Jennifer Holmdy says the planes collided yesterday afternoon. 16 people were on board the planes and two people are still unaccounted for. And former President Jimmy Carter is healing after a surgery to fix his broken hip. A statement from the Carter Center says the former president broke his hip when he fell at his home in Plains, Georgia, and calls the surgery successful. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We all have our ups and downs, and some days may even be all down. And we all have our ways of dealing with it. Maybe we take a nap, maybe we pray, maybe we watch a comedy, maybe we, you know, indulge in a dish of ice cream. New research is suggesting another way, which is turning outward towards others, rather than centering on ourselves. With me right now is Dr. Gregory Popcheck, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, a Catholic telecounseling practice, providing marriage and mental health counseling services to Catholics worldwide. Together with his wife, Lisa, he is author of over, he is the author of over 20 books on relationships and spirituality, and you hear them both each day on 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 9 Central, on the radio program More to Life, produced by Ave Maria Radio and carried by the EWTN Radio Network. Greg, good to have you with me.
Great to be here, Al. Thank you.
People frequently mention, how you feeling? Well, I'm up, or I'm down, or I'm not so good, or I'm struggling, or sure. I'm happy. Life's good, you know. People have all kinds of emotional ups and downs and vacillations through the day. And we all have ways of dealing with it. What are some of the healthier ways of dealing with it?
Well, this is an interesting study from Iowa State University, right? And whatever you're feeling, whatever your answer to that question, how are you feeling today, might be, whether it's good or bad or somewhere in between. What this study shows is that wishing good for others and doing something good for others is perhaps one of the most powerful ways to elevate your mood and specifically to combat anxiety. What the researchers looked at were three conditions, and there was a control group as well. But they looked at loving kindness, which they defined as wishing good for the other person and perhaps doing something to try to make a small difference. I mean, we're talking about like opening a door or, you know, smiling at the person, simple things like that, right? This was a very short, small study. In fact, they did this over a period of 12 minutes and showed that even a small amount of time can have a significant improvement in the person's mood by doing these things. But so they had three conditions: loving kindness, interconnectedness, which was looking at other people as you walked around the building and try to think about how you're connected to that other person in some way. And then the third way was what they called downward social comparison. That's kind of when you look at others and think about how you might be better off than those people in some way. And what they found was that of the three conditions, the people who engaged in the most loving kindness, who wished the best for others and tried to find small ways they could make a difference in that person's life, experienced the biggest boost in emotions, even over a short 12-minute period, from the time that they started to the time that they finished the study. It was kind of fascinating, because on the one hand, it's a very limited study, because it's a small sample in a very small period of time. On the other hand, when you look at that and you say, you know, you can make a significant enough change in your mood for it to be able to be detected on a psychological test in just 12 minutes by being kinder to others, imagine what that would be like if you did it 24 hours, 7 days a week.
So this has actually become something that you can make into a spiritual discipline.
Well, sure. And, you know, the Second Vatican Council in Gaudium et Spes talks about how we find ourselves by making a gift of ourselves. And this is a perfect example of that. You know, we find the joy we're looking for even by looking for simple ways we can make a difference in the lives of others. It doesn't have to be a big, giant, heroic effort. It could be something as simple as smiling at that person, looking at them in the eye, holding the door for them, asking yourself, you know, what's one little thing I could do to bring a smile to that person's face? As you're going about your day, it doesn't have to take a ton of energy and a ton of, thought even. It just requires being a little more intentional about how you connect with others and work for their good, and maybe pulling ourselves out of our own heads for a minute to try to be present to others in a new way.
Does this, is there one way better than another for certain personality types?
Yeah, they were looking at that, actually. And in fact, they thought that perhaps narcissistic people, people with narcissistic tendencies, would have more of an emotional boost by thinking about their connection to other people. But what they found across the board, regardless of your personality type, loving kindness, wishing good for others, doing good for others, had the most benefit for every personality type. So it was almost a universal experience for the participants in the study.
Huh. Does social media have any relationship to this? Since that's
interesting.
A major change in the way that we communicate.
Well, you know, other research has pointed out how social media does tend to have a pretty negative impact on emotional health. People, you can kind of track the number of hours a person spends on social media and kind of have a good correspondence between that and their risk for depression and anxiety disorders, largely because of what they're talking about here, the social comparison piece. You know, where in the study they were asking, you know, people to walk around the building and sort of see how you might be better than them. The reality is on social media, we always compare ourselves to others, and because others' lives look so glossy, we always negatively compare ourselves to those people. And because of that, it tends to undermine our sense of self-confidence and our sense of self-esteem. So, you know, even though social media can be helpful when it's used to support real relationship and maintain connection in a meaningful way with people, the more time we spend on it, the more we have a tendency to negatively compare ourselves to others, which does undermine that sense of happiness.
You know, comparing ourselves with others is such a chronic part of our life and our upbringing. When does it work well?
Yeah, you know, we actually were talking about this on the show today. We did a show that touched on themes of envy, and I talk about this, in fact, in my book, Broken Gods, Hope, Healing, and the Seven Longings of the Human Heart, in the chapter on envy. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with looking at another person's life and saying, you know, there's something about that person's life that appeals to me. You know, yeah. I'd like that. And when we do that in godly ways, we're able to take that to prayer and say, you know, Lord, is that something you want for me? And then, you know, if that stands up in the face of prayer, then we start to make a plan for making those changes or acquiring those skills. And that's a good thing. That's how we grow. We encourage each other through that example. Where it becomes problematic is where we say, somehow the fact that that person has that thing or is in that condition in life means that they're better than I am. So I see their blessing as some sort of condemnation of my worth or dignity as a person.
So they're not just better off, they're better.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, and so, you know, the fact that they have those things mean that I'm not as worthwhile as they are. So, you know, I talk in Broken Gods about how envy is really a twisting of the divine longing for dignity. We all long to know that we're worthwhile and that we're good and we have value. But we sometimes mistakenly attribute that value to having the same amount of stuff, or having the same kind of stuff as the other person has. And as long as we see it that way, that's where envy comes in, where if I see somebody with a bigger pile of stuff than me or stuff in their pile that I don't have, it makes me not just say, oh, they have better stuff, they're a better person, and yeah. I don't matter as much. So then I want to rob their joy or somehow treat them in a way that steals their happiness because it's just not fair. It's a way of kind of equaling the playing field. Whereas, you know, the treatment for envy is really kind of bringing that all to God and saying, you know, help me to see my dignity and worth in your eyes, Lord, and see that in your love and recognize that, you know, you will bring into my life all the things that I need to be happy and fulfilled, just like a loving father would for any of his children.
There's a large body of research that demonstrates that making good social connections sustains us in a good emotional place. Mm-hmm. What does that tell us theologically?
That we were not made to be alone. You know, right. The theology of the body.
Right.
But, I mean, it says in Genesis, you know, it's not good for man to be alone, you know, as God is looking at Adam, right? But the theology of the body really builds on that and points out the fact that we were created for communion, that there's no such thing as sort of an individual, that we are part of something, even when we're on by ourselves. And the more we can make that connection, the better. In fact, there's some interesting biological evidence for that. You know, brain research has found that the brain tends to default to more negative emotional states when we don't feel connected to other people. That's sort of the default. That we, you know, how, you know, you can, somebody can give you a, like, you know, 100 people can give you a compliment, and one person says something negative. What do you focus on?
Yeah.
The negative thing,
right.
Well, the we tend to do that, especially if we don't feel connected to other people. But when we do feel that sense of social connection, the mind actually reorients toward a more positive direction. And if you look at that kind of from a, if you will, an evolutionary sort of standpoint, you know, if I'm walking through the woods by myself, I got to be looking out for threats. I got to be worried about the mountain lion jumping out from behind the bush or something, right? But if I'm with my tribe, I can just relax and enjoy the walk,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's the same thing, you know, that when I don't feel connected to others, my mind will default to those negative states and negative assumptions, whereas when I feel connected to more people, then I'm going to feel more positively and be less likely to react negatively to other folks.
Yeah, I've always thought that passage is underutilized in most people's lives.
Yeah.
It is not good for man to be alone, because that was made before the fall. Everything
right.
else that God looked upon that he had created was good or very good. But it wasn't good that man was alone. And that's not, you know, that tells me right there that it's part of God's creational design that we not be alone.
And that, you know, it's a really important point, because this comes up a lot in my line of work and on the program, you know, where people will say, you know, oh, you know, I want a better marriage, or I want a better relationship with my kids, or I want, you know, more connection with other people, but you know, I can't have that, so I should just be happy with God. Well, how, you know, so I just want God to fill up all those spots in my heart. And, you know, that sounds really pious, and the intention is really good, but it's also not what we were made for.
Right.
You know,
right.
We
right.
got, you know, even before the fall, you know, when Adam was completely unified with God and
yep.
all of creation, it still wasn't enough for him. And
right.
God recognized that, and that's why he created other. He created Eve to be in relationship with, and it's a sign for all of us that, you know, that God wants to give us his love through other people. And so working on those relationships is a godly act that allows us to connect with God's grace in more meaningful ways.
So summarize for me these three ways that we can help improve our moods. Loving kindness
sure.
was first.
Yeah, which is wishing and doing good for others. The other way was interconnectedness, trying to look at how we're connected to other people. And the third way they tried was, you know, thinking, I'm better off than that person because of thus and such and this and that. And what they found was in every single case, regardless of the participant's personality type or condition in life, loving kindness, that desire to wish the good for the other person and do simple things, like I said, like smiling at them, opening a door for them, you know, just doing little things to make a difference or put a smile on their face, made the biggest difference in decreasing anxiety and increasing happiness.
Well, Greg, tell people how they can stay in touch with you and how they can benefit from the Pastoral Solutions Institute.
They can learn more about all of our resources, including the book I mentioned, Broken Gods, Hope, Healing, and the Seven Longings of the Human Heart, and the Pastoral Solutions Institute's telephone counseling practice by going to CatholicCounselors.com.
Greg, thanks so much. We'll talk again soon.
Always a pleasure, Al. Thank you.
Dr. Gregory Popcheck, again, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute. I'm Al Cresta.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Not everyone who's attracted to the Lord and to a life of service is necessarily meant to be a priest. So there's all kinds of forms. I mean, from, let's say, the brotherhood, if you want to stay within a formal religious context, but then all kinds of ministries within a parish, all kinds of lay ministries that you can do. So not everyone's called to the priesthood. A priest is someone who is dedicated, devoted to ongoing study and ongoing prayer, to be a spiritual father. As Pope Benedict said, one of his wisest remarks, he said, people want many things from a priest, but what they want above all is someone who's a master of the spiritual life. Hey, I'm great at this ministry, and hey, I'm great at organizing this meeting, and hey, I'm great. Fine, but ultimately what the people want is you're a master of the spiritual life. You got to be, therefore, trained in prayer and theology and spirituality and so on.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What qualifies as a valid marriage in the eyes of the Catholic Church? The Catechism tells us there are certain requirements that must be present or the marriage is not a true sacrament. The requirements are as follows. The marriage must be between a baptized man and a baptized woman who are free to contract marriage and who freely express their consent. The Catechism defines freedom to contract as not being under constraint and not impeded by any natural or ecclesiastical law. The exchange of consent between the spouses is considered by the church to be the most indispensable element of a valid marriage. According to the Catechism, the consent must be an act of the will of each party, free of coercion or grave external fear. If this freedom is lacking, the marriage is not valid. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. I want to announce that Steve Ray and I will be going on pilgrimage to the great land of Poland, August 21st to August 30th.
We're going to follow John Paul II, Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and Maximilian Kolbe. We're even going to visit Auschwitz and see the place where Maximilian Kolbe gave his life in the cell there.
People can get more information at AveMariaRadio.net. And where else, Steve?
CatholicConvert.com. Click on the big pilgrimage banner or call 866-468-1420.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. People complain about the collapse of the family, the rise of socialism, the neglect of the church. Well, stop complaining and learn how to build the foundations for a free and virtuous society at Acton University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, June 18th to 21st. You'll be learning from great thinkers, activists, entrepreneurs, and hundreds of highly motivated men and women like yourself. Check out university.acton.org. That's university.acton.org.
It's practically an epidemic. 20% of Americans suffer from anxiety disorders, and millions more wrestle with worry and stress on a daily basis. For us as Christians, all that worry gets mixed up with a lot of guilt. How can we stop worrying and start living an anxiety-free life? I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, and in my new book, Unworried, A Life Without Anxiety, you'll learn how to respect how God made us and build new habits of thinking, communicating, and acting that will help set you free from worry. You can get your copy of Unworried and any of my other books at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Cardinal Joseph Minzenti was a hero of the Cold War that many Americans have forgotten. He was persecuted by communists and was abandoned by his church for a time. However, in February of this year, he was declared venerable. And it's time for us to recall the heroic life of Cardinal Joseph Minzenti. Helping us do that is Dr. Paul Kengor, professor of political science at Grove City College, the author of over a dozen books, including A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul, good to have you back here.
Yeah, thanks, Al. Great to be here to talk about this very important man.
Let's look at him, and I also want to make sure we talk about why he was almost forgotten, I think, by at least American Catholics. When was he born?
Well, he was born in 1892, and he's Hungarian. In fact, he's from the town of Minzent, which is really from which his family name. He was Joseph Minzenti. That's where the name comes from.
Okay.
So he was there. He was born late 19th century, and he would eventually become a priest up through that very tumultuous time of the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, World War One, 1914 to 1918. And he was one of those priests, you know, as well as someone who would later be known as Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, the future Pope Pius XII, who was ordained and became kind of a leading clergyman right around that period, 1918, 1919, when the war ended and countries like Germany, Bavaria, Austria, Austria-Hungary, they were not only transitioning out of monarchy, but they were under threat by communists because the Bolsheviks had taken over in Russia. In fact,
right.
in Bavaria, Pacelli faced what was to be called a Bavarian Soviet Republic, and they tried to kill. They actually tried to murder Pacelli, the future Pope Pius XII, And the same thing happened with Mindenti, who was in Hungary under what was known as the Hungarian Soviet Republic, under an awful leader named Béla Kun, who, among others, you and I have talked about this before, but he had a culture and education secretary by the name of George Lukács, who became one of the founding fathers of the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism.
Yes.
But they tried to stop, and they tried to knock off Mindenti very early on. So he's there for all of these battles, World War One, World War Two, Cold War, all the way up through.
So he endured the Nazis then during the Second World War.
He did. So he survives Béla Kun and you know, that crew, 1918, 1919. And then, you know, a little bit of a respite in the 1920s and 1930s. But then the Nazis came in. And he resisted the Nazis. The Nazis had him tossed into jail. In fact, he was still in jail once the communists came in and liberated as they like to put it. And later on too, Stalin and the Soviets and the communists would do to Mindenti what they did to Pope Pius XII and so many other different cardinals and leaders of the day. They'd later accuse him of being a Nazi collaborator, which, you know, they'd later call Pius XII Hitler's Pope.
Yeah,
which is why anybody with any knowledge of the history of this period, Al, would know right away, they'd be suspicious right away when they'd see that tag applied to Pius XII.
Sure.
Because that's simply what the communists did. If they didn't like you, they called you a fascist and accused you of collaborating with the Nazis. And of course, the other communists in the Kremlin would, you know, chortle and laugh and say, well, of course, he never did collaborate with the Nazis. He actually saved Jews, but that doesn't matter.
This was
their standard disinformation, and which would later be picked up, unfortunately, by a lot of leftists in the West who peddled the disinformation. But I digress.
Well, but Mindenti, during the communist era, did he have any period of freedom once the communists came in?
Well, they came in and the short answer is really no. But they arrested him on December 26, 1948.
Wow.
He was with his mother. His mother was there with him and had brought some cookies and some food, and they were celebrating a quiet Christmas together. And 16 secret police from the communist secret police, about the number of Nazis that had arrested him a few years earlier, kicked in the door and came in, arrested him in the middle of the night, and hauled him off. And in fact, the only break that he really had before that was when he went to Rome and received the cardinal's hat from Pius XII. And Pius XII even said, you are the first of these 32 whose martyrdom is the color of this hat. He predicted when he gave him the red Zucchetto that he would be martyred. In fact, he was with Fulton Sheen later, called the dry martyr. In that he didn't actually die. He wasn't actually killed, but that they definitely bloodied him, or really they bloodied the people around him. In his case, it was more of a torture. Mental torture, drugging, and to the point, once the communists arrested him December 26, 1948, they took him to communist police headquarters at 60 Andrassy Street, and there they would keep him awake 48 hours, 72 hours. They drugged him. They tortured him. At one point, they brought in two nuns and beat the nuns up in front of him. And his head was so confused. He was so drugged up that he couldn't even put his two swollen hands together to pray for the two nuns. And then when they were done with the two nuns, they brought in a couple priests and did the same thing. And he had said before all this, Al, that if he signs a quote unquote confession, don't take it seriously because it'll be done under drugging and duress.
Right.
It shouldn't be considered a real confession. and that's exactly what happened, and until he was freed in 1956 momentarily.
Why was he such a threat?
Well, basically because he was the leader of the Catholic Church in communist Hungary.
Yeah.
He was courageous, fearless. He absolutely stood up to these guys. He defended the church no matter what. He wasn't going to let the communists appoint priests and bishops. And the communists, they all said, Lenin, Stalin, Marx, Engels, even communists in the United States, like Earl Browder, the leader of Communist Party USA in the 1930s, they said that, religion is the foe.
Right.
The chief enemy is religion. And above all, the Catholic Church was the very worst because no other institution had opposed communism like the Catholic Church through all the encyclicals. And in Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church caved in.
Right.
And
right.
It even allowed Stalin to meddle, to appoint bishops, to infiltrate churches. But the Catholic Church refused. And in fact, this is really another terrific testimony to Pius XII. When Mindszenty was put on trial, quote unquote, after his confession by the communists, in what was absolutely a show trial, a kangaroo court, Pope Pius XII excommunicated everybody who was involved in the trial against Mindszenty, excommunicated the whole group of them. And of course, when that happened, that enraged the Soviets even more, and they just started screaming, "Hitler's Pope! Hitler's Pope!"
Yeah.
Anything that they could.
Well, that actually brings up what becomes just a tragic injustice to Cardinal Mindszenty. Eventually, the excommunication of those people who participated in the show trial are actually lifted, and his titles are revoked by Paul VI. How did that happen?
Well, he was a very important thing in the interim. In 1956, when the Soviets invaded Hungary, this was late October, early November 1956, the famous Hungarian freedom fighters, he was sprung free momentarily. And at that point, Al, he could have escaped to the West, like hundreds of thousands of Hungarians. Mm-hmm. But he said, no, I'm going to stay here with my people.
Right.
So he was moved into the U.S. Embassy in Budapest, where he lived for the next 15 years, unable to leave the grounds of the U.S. Embassy, or the communists would have either arrested him or put him on a plane and forcibly sent him out of the country. So he stayed at the U.S. Embassy for 15 years.
Yeah.
And then in 1971, Paul VI, who was an Ostpolitik pope, this was the kind of Western European, West German version of détente,
mm-hmm.
along with his Secretary of State, Cardinal Cassaroli, their approach to the Soviets was one of accommodation. Let's see if we can get along with them. Let's try to get along better. We'll make some concessions to Moscow. We'll listen to them on some of these things, and that maybe that will help to lead to peace. Maybe that'll give us a step back into these countries. Maybe we could have more influence through conciliation rather than confrontation, like under Pius XII. And so one of the major concessions that Cassaroli and Paul VI made to the Kremlin was to agree to force Mindszenty out of Hungary, and which I think was really a shameless, cowardly thing that the Vatican did. And by the way, so did Mindszenty. Mindszenty hated it.
Yeah.
So under pressure from his church, from his pope, he was obedient, and he left. And to Paul VI's credit, he refused to fill Mindszenty's seats while he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
He left it vacated. But he eventually, 1973, 74, even came to America. My good friend Bill Clark met him, was one of his hosts at that point in time, because Bill Clark was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff. Then he came to California, and Clark would have been Governor Reagan's chief of staff in California at that time. But he eventually died of a broken heart, really, in 1975, feeling that his church had let him down.
Paul, can you stay with me a little longer?
Sure, be happy to.
Dr. Paul Kengor, my guest, we're looking at getting familiar with the life of Cardinal Joseph Mindzente, who was declared venerable in February of this year. But he's a figure, a titan in the Cold War, largely forgotten by many American Catholics today. I'm Al Kressel. We'll be right back. This month, you can bless Catholic mothers struggling to care for their families in developing countries. They spend hours collecting drinking water from rivers and often unsafe sources. With your support, Cross Catholic Outreach provides these women and their children with access to clean, safe water. Lift the poor's burdens, protect their health, and restore their hope. Call Cross Catholic Outreach at 888-766-2426 or visit crosscatholic.org/Ave Maria.
Want to grow as a Catholic evangelist? St. Paul Street Evangelization invites you to join them this June 6th through the 9th in Detroit, Michigan for their Immersion 2019 Evangelization Training Intensive. You'll learn how to better share the truth and love of Jesus and His church. Featuring dynamic talks, breakouts, daily mass, prayer, fellowship, and hands-on training with 15 hours of street evangelization. For more information or to register, visit www.streetevangelization.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
Join today's discussion and engage with producers on the Ave Maria Radio Facebook and Twitter accounts at Ave Maria Radio. Respond to interviews and learn who's coming up on Crest in the Afternoon, Catholic Connection, and other Ave Maria Radio programs. Make it easier by downloading the Ave Maria app on your smart devices. Then just tap on the Facebook and Twitter icons to get plugged in on the things that matter most. That's the Ave Maria Radio app or at Ave Maria Radio. Build the church. Bless the nations.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
The radical hard left, which now controls the mainstream Democratic Party, has declared war against conservatives, and in particular, conservative Christians and Jews. The propaganda arm of this assault is the George Soros-funded Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC. For years, SPLC has engaged in a political propaganda campaign to malign its political adversaries by falsely labeling them as hate groups. SPLC operates much like Joseph Goebbels' notorious Ministry of Propaganda for the Nazi Party, functioning as purveyors of hate. For SPLC, it has become a very profitable business. It has over $500 million in assets, with over $120 million parked in offshore accounts. As you can see, this enemy of liberty is well-funded, and it seeks to weaponize financial agencies, left-wing government officials, and others against conservative Judeo-Christian values. Make no mistake, SPLC is an enemy of the state. Its business of identity politics and name-calling, the main tactic of the left, is harmful to our nation. It foments violence. It seeks to divide America. It wants nothing less than the institution of a hard-left regime in which conservative Christians and Jews and the values they hold dear are cast aside. Don't be fooled. With the assistance of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the policies of the hard left, which are now becoming mainstream for the Democratic Party, inevitably lead to totalitarianism. But I say, defend liberty. Resist the left, its propaganda, and its so-called progressive policies. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Kressel. With me is Dr. Paul Kengor, looking over the life of Cardinal Joseph Mindzente, again, one of the great figures of the Catholic struggle against communism. And his life also shows us some of the problems with the way, at various times, with the way the church handled its fight with the communists. Eventually, he was taken into the U.S. Embassy, where he stayed for years. And by the way, there's a funny story about this. One Halloween, the embassy had a costume party, and some employees were still wearing their masks, and they were leaving the building. They were accosted by flashlight-bearing secret police who pulled up their mask looking for the cardinal. They assumed the cardinal was trying to escape under one of those masks, and that was apparently the last Halloween party in the building there, according to the U.S. Embassy website. Cardinal Mindszenty was in the U.S. Embassy for how many years, Paul?
So that goes from when the Soviets invaded Hungary in 1956, and that was a really big deal, Al. That was probably the worst thing that the Soviets did between the end of World War II and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. They had two invasions during that time within the Warsaw Pact. So one was Czechoslovakia in 1968, and the other was Hungary in 1956. But Hungary was the worst of them. The Red Army came in and killed thousands of Hungarians. And to this day, it's hard to get numbers. It could have been as high as 30,000. It's definitely multiple thousand, probably somewhere in the range of 5,000 to 10,000. It was such a big deal that Fulton Sheen did a Life is Worth Living broadcast on the situation and on Cardinal Mindszenty. Ronald Reagan did a GE Theater episode.
Wow.
where he did a plug. The Time Magazine that year, Time Magazine's Man of the Year for 1956 was the Hungarian freedom fighter. But Mindszenty said, "I am going to stay with my people."
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I am the leader of this flock. I am the shepherd, and I am going to stay here. You are not going to force me out of the country. And so he stayed in the embassy for 15 years until his pope forced him out of the country.
Is there a reason? It sounds as though the Polish people, by comparison, the Polish Catholics had more leverage than the Hungarian Catholics did. Do you know what the relative liberties were between the Poles and the Hungarians?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's probably just more a matter of numbers, I would think, Al, because Poland was, the data that we had by the mid-1980s was that quite literally 90% of Poland was Roman Catholic. And in fact, to this day, that's true. And you know, unlike some other even Western European nations like Ireland and France and probably even Italy, where you had 90% numbers, the population wasn't that devout.
Mm-hmm.
In France to this day, when you read that 10% of French Catholics practice the faith, you look deeper into the numbers and you see that that's defined as attending mass once a month.
Right.
It's not even once a week. But in Poland to this day, they're very devout.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just the strength of those numbers. Hungary never had a Catholic population that high, but the Catholics that were there were strong. They were solid, and Mindszenty was probably comparable to a leader like Stefan Wyszynski in Poland.
That's what I was thinking.
Who was the senior cardinal to Cardinal Wojtyła, who became John Paul II.
He became really. He was also the youngest bishop in Poland at one time, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I guess I'm trying to get a feel for this Ostpolitik that was practiced by Paul VI, John XXIII, and Paul VI, and how it differs from the policy that John Paul II put into place. Help us make that transition, would you?
Yeah, and I'm glad you're asking, because it forced me to be more charitable to Paul VI, which I try to do in my books too. I always, I think in my first draft of A Pope and a President, where I talked about this, I really let all my steam off, and then I went back and revised and toned it down a little bit, right? But in fact, Cardinal Casseroli, who would remain as the Secretary of State under John Paul II.
Yeah, that's what I'm
John
curious.
Paul, yeah, it's interesting that he held him over. But Casseroli would call this the martyrdom of patience. The martyrdom of patience.
Interesting.
So he and Paul VI, you know, they felt in their defense that the more hardline approach of Pius XII, which I hesitate to call hardline because I think it was just a courageous approach of opposing genuinely evil guys. But,
right. But
they said, well, this isn't getting us very far. The communist world is still divided. Communism still has a hold on Eastern Europe. So maybe if we kind of do like what Nixon is doing in the United States,
right. Try
to find a way to talk to these guys, get them to the negotiating table, go in and sit down with them, sit down with the leadership of Bulgaria, as Casseroli did. And in fact, I talk about that in A Pope and a President. That's enormously embarrassing when Casseroli met with the Bulgarians, Todor Zivkov, one of the worst dictators in all of Eastern Europe, and talks about him in these glowing terms.
Oh.
And then just 3 or 4 years later, the Bulgarians worked with Mehmet Ali Asha to put a couple bullets in Pope John Paul II.
Right.
Which shows you, how well the accommodation went, right? You know, they slap you on the back and make you think that they're buddies with you. And then they go and they order an assassination attempt on your Pope.
Yeah. Yeah.
So But Paul VI and Casseroli at least tried that approach. It failed. And a great example of the transition to the popes is when John Paul II talked about it was probably Mindszenty's replacement, actually, in Hungary later, who had urged John Paul II to come visit Hungary in 1980, 1981. And John Paul II said, tell the Cardinal of Hungary that the Bishop of Rome will come and visit Hungary when the Cardinal of Hungary learns to bang his fist on the table. So in other words, when the Cardinal of Hungary is willing to look across the table from the communists and say no, he's willing to bang his fist on the table. And so John Paul II at the Vatican, like Ronald Reagan in the White House, said, it's time to stop this accommodation stuff. It's not working. We try to shake their hand. We extend an olive branch. And what do? They invade Afghanistan.
Right.
They tighten their grip on Eastern Europe. The church is less and less free. Instead, we're going to try an approach of squeezing the Soviet Union, calling them out, calling them an evil empire, aiding the Solidarity Movement, and doing what we can to try to peacefully reverse and defeat communism in Eastern Europe and the USSR.
Now, Cardinal Mindszenty died, what was it, 75?
That's right.
Yeah. In 75. So he never saw the change that came about as a result of Pope John Paul II and the election of Ronald Reagan. Do we have any idea his attitudes towards the end of his life? Did he write? Did he communicate with people clearly?
He was, from my understanding, he was, I don't want to use the word depressed, but he was pretty down about the whole thing. He wondered if his suffering had really bore any fruit.
Yeah.
And Bill Clark told me that when he met him in California, and this would have been 73 or 74, it was for Mindszenty had come to San Francisco and was going to speak at the University of Santa Clara, which turned into a big blow up with protesters and all sorts of, it turned into a messy situation. But Clark said to me that he said Mindszenty just looked tired. He looked worn out. He said he just had this look and feel that he didn't want to fight anymore.
Yeah.
That he had spent an entire life battling these people. And Clark even told me, he said, I considered Mindszenty the ultimate crime fighter. I'll never forget that phrase, the crime fighter, a man who fought criminals, who fought ideological gangsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so by the end, he was pretty worn out. And I think Bishop Fulton Sheen labeled way back in the 1950s, the dry martyr of Hungary. I think that very much applies.
Yeah.
And in a way, he's only getting his due now by, oh, God bless him, Pope Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And the congregation for the cause of the saints, as they're now recognizing him as venerable, which is a way of formally declaring that the man in his lifetime demonstrated genuinely heroic virtue.
Do you know in any particular detail why Pope Paul VI thought it in any way prudent to lift his titles? That just seems to be especially cruel.
Yeah, and I'd like to know more about it. I feel that that's something that somebody with access to interviews, archives, and unfortunately, the Vatican archives and any correspondence on this, it has a 75-year seal on it. So you won't know until, if I'm doing my math right, the year 2046.
I see.
At that point, so
yeah.
I got another 25 years or so.
Yeah. Well, you'll be there. You'll be able to do it.
Maybe. I don't. But it would be really good to see that and see just how he felt about it. I've read. In fact, you had the author on your show not that long ago. The Canadian historian who did a wonderful book on the president of Vietnam.
Yes.
Who was betrayed. And there's a great interview exchange there between him and Paul VI. And Paul VI is saying, he's very apologetic. He's saying, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I know how bad it is.
Yeah.
I know how bad it is. But I just feel that this is what I have to do. This is not a good situation. I know. I don't like it. But this is what I'm going to try to do.
Yeah.
Whereas the Pius XII would have just said in effect, too bad, right? You're excommunicated.
Yeah.
So Paul VI was, I guess, much more willing to try to do that. But it failed. It didn't work.
It's just that there are many ways of cooperating with your enemy. That just seemed, it's hard to figure out, hard for me to understand why that would be of any great benefit at that late period. I mean, by that time, Zentu was quite old, you know, and...
Right, like, yeah, you really want to know what was the deal,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
What's supposed to happen here?
Yeah.
Is this more like a Jimmy Carter situation where... okay, well, if we do this, they're really going to like that.
Right.
Right.
And
we hope that leads to some genuine, quote unquote, improvement.
Yeah.
Right. Or
yeah.
something like that. You know, no, I want, if you're going to do this, I want you to promise me A, B, and C. And I want to see A, B, and C done by the end of this year. In fact, I want A and B done first.
Right.
Right.
Right. Before I do anything. Yeah. Paul, thank you so much. Great talking with you. We'll talk soon.
All right, thanks.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Let us strive to know the Lord. Quick question to you and me right now. Is that what you and I are doing every single day? When you and I wake up every day, do we strive to know Jesus or not? In the Old Testament, in the same book of Hosea, a little bit later on, it's in chapter 14, the Lord says through the prophet, "My people perish." Or in another translation, "My people are being destroyed because of a lack of knowledge." Not a lack of data. We got tons of data. Not a lack of information. We got a lot of information. Not just about things that are happening in the world. We got a lot of data, a lot of knowledge, a lot of information about God. But not a lot of intimacy with God. Not a lot of relationship with God. Not a lot of friendship. That's the cry of God's heart. God wants to give himself to us in the incredible gift of friendship. And we're not taking advantage of it.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more. And I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Well, thank you for being with me over this last hour, and there's more coming up, of course. The material we covered in the first hour, though, on quick fixes for a bad mood, we'll have more information on that in the Cresta Guest Archive. So if you want to find out more, read some of the articles related to the studies, we have them there. Also, follow-up material with Dr. Gregory Popcheck available for you there as well. And then we have a number of articles dealing with Cardinal Joseph Mincenti, and has now been declared venerable, and it's none too soon. The theology of the body is, well, let's put it this way, it's important for Catholics to begin thinking in terms of the theology of the body, especially during this period in which gender and sexuality are being, well, confused. We're going to talk over the theology of the body for children with Dr. Andrew Sodergren, who's been working on this for Ruah Woods Press. They do remarkable work. Met them last November in Baltimore when I was at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting. So Andrew will be with us in just a little while, because right now we've got situations where transgendered athletes are taking first and second places in the Connecticut State Track Championships for girls. And this is front page stuff around the country right now. What does the theology of the body have to say to these situations? And also we'll look at the transhumanist movement, which is merging artificial and natural intelligence. Is it a threat or is it a blessing? I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me on this edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. We're going to take a look at a movement which is gaining momentum in Western society. It is what's commonly called the transhumanist movement, although there are other less well-known names for it. It's a movement which attempts to extend the human lifespan. That's one of its chief projects. But above all, it's a movement that believes that we are, that is, humans, are the evolutionary process that's become conscious of itself, and that we now are to take control of that process. The problem is that transhumanists don't generally believe that life has any purpose. So we are evolving towards what? They don't have any sense of purpose. Consequently, people have all kinds of objectives and goals that they want to lay out for the human future. We're going to talk about the transhumanist movement with Dr. Jacob Schatzer, who's written widely on it. We're also going to talk with Dr. Andrew Sodergren about the theology of the body for children. And it's come to the point where we have to begin to address these issues of gender and sexual identity early on, because the world is forcing this discussion upon us. Well, let's give it to them with the kind of dynamic display that we see in John Paul II's writings. We're going to take a look at the theology of the body for children as it's being developed by Ruha Woods Press. Dr. Andrew Sodergren, my guest. But first, we'll get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, May 14th. It's the Feast of St. Matthias. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. In pro-life news, Alabama senators are set to vote on a bill that would ban abortions except to prevent serious health risks. State senators will consider whether to make exceptions for rape or incest. This comes after Mississippi and Georgia passed laws banning abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Meanwhile, the Michigan State Senate has passed a bill to ban dismemberment abortions. The State House is considering an identical bill. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has vowed to veto any bills restricting abortion. Attorney General Bill Barr is looking into the root of the Russia investigation. Barr has assigned U.S. Attorney John Durham to lead the probe that will examine how the investigation's initial intelligence was gathered. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso agrees with Barr's decision.
Well, I think this leads to giving the American people what they want in terms of accountability and transparency to see what really happened, what started the investigations.
Durham is the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut and has led public corruption investigations under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Election files in two Florida counties were hacked by Russia in 2016. That's what Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis said today, adding no votes were manipulated and results were not altered in any way. The governor said he also met with the FBI as well as state election and law enforcement officials regarding the hack. Senator Elizabeth Warren is turning down an offer to take part in a Fox News town hall broadcast. The Democratic presidential candidate calls the network a, quote, hate-for-profit racket that gives a megaphone to racists and conspiracy lovers. An actor and comedian, Tim Conway, has died at the age of 85. Conway was a star in The Carol Burnett Show and also starred in a number of Disney films. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. When two high school athletes who were born male, but now identify as female, took first and second place at Connecticut Girls Indoor Track Championship this year, it became a national story. And to some, it was a story of triumph and courage. To others, it was a story of shock and disappointment. Is this the end of women's sports? Well, I don't know. But what I do know is that we are more and more being forced to think about what the reality of gender and sex and maleness and femaleness. And we are blessed to have, within recent Catholic history, an extraordinary amount of reflection on this topic because of St. John Paul II's work on theology of the body. Joining me right now is Dr. Andrew Sodergren, a Catholic therapist and psychologist whose work is shaped by his Catholic understanding of the human person as a relational, incarnate being made out of love and for love. You can follow his work at rwpsych.org. And you can learn more about the Theology of the Body for Teachers sessions, which are coming up in June and August, at ruawoodpress.com, ruawoodspress.com. We'll have it linked at our site as well. That's R-U-A-H, Woods, plural, press.com. And Dr. Sodergren, good to have you here. Thanks.
Thanks, Al. It's great to be here with you.
Let's talk a little bit about the urgency of getting a grasp of the theology of the body. I don't think when John Paul II began working on this material, he was yet envisioning that we would be living in a period shortly after his passing from this world that regards the transgender movement as the greatest civil rights movement since the African-American civil rights movement. I don't want to get to the politics of this necessarily, but I am interested in what does the Catholic faith say in terms of who we are as persons to this transgendered movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's hard to know exactly what John Paul II, was envisioning with theology of the body in terms of future struggles. But we know that when he wrote this, which was in the late 70s when he put pen to paper, he was responding to, the contraceptive culture and the sexual revolution that was in full swing at that time. And I think a very strong argument can be made in which this, transgender movement that we see now is just a further extension of that line of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's the same anthropology underlying contraception, underlying abortion, underlying pornography, and now underlining sex reassignment and transgenderism. Because one of the common themes among all of those behaviors and the ideology that promote those behaviors is that the body is not me. The body is just—it's just stuff.
Right.
And our job as human beings is to make it be whatever we want it to be. Our body and our sexuality doesn't have any inherent meaning or purpose to it, other than what we assign to it. And contraception was a huge tool, towards this end, right? Because now I can turn my fertility on and off.
Right.
And transgenderism is just taking that another step. It's now I can remake my body in my image, the image that I think it should be. I don't have to be bound by it and by the sexuality reflected in my body. And so in Theology of the Body, John Paul II attempts to respond to this trend by laying down some principles of Catholic anthropology in a kind of new and compelling way. And he talks at length about how God made us male and female, and our maleness and femaleness are not an afterthought. They're inherent in our personhood as human beings. That God created us male and female is has great theological significance. And in fact, he talks about how through being made male and female, we are able to form a communion of persons, namely marriage and family, that becomes an icon of the Trinity. And he says that we image God more fully in that way than the individual human person alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really significant thing. And he's saying that male and femaleness are inherent in what it means to image God. Not that God is male or female, but God is a communion of persons. And it is through male and female on the human level that we're able to form the fullest expression of communion of persons this side of heaven, what we see in marriage and family life.
I was hearing about a school district the other day that has dropped the term male and female in favor of gender assigned at birth. And
so this
is going to be really affecting young people, even before adults have come to grips with all that's involved here. It's been astounding the speed at which transgenderism has become an ideology and basically a political movement for what was originally a psychological concern about gender dysphoria. It's mutated into a political movement with a whole metaphysic to it, a new anthropology. And so I am very concerned about now my grandchildren, as they grow up, what they're going to be subjected to in schools. And so what should a teacher say and do when a student suffering from, gender dysphoria or sexual identity confusion wants accommodations? How do you help without buying in to the whole package?
Right. This is one of the things that we're most concerned with here at Rua Woods, the ministry where I work, you know, we're all about promoting theology of the body, and in particular helping our Catholic schools to bring it into the classroom. And I have serious concerns that this issue of gender ideology is and will continue to be a major threat to our Catholic schools, because as you pointed out, we're seeing more and more how sort of militant and aggressive the powers that be are in pushing this ideology. And as Catholics, we can't accept that. We can't promote that in our schools. We believe that God made us male and female, and male and female is inherent to our identity and our mission. And so if we're going to be faithful to our mission as Catholic schools, which ultimately is evangelization, we have to be faithful to that message. And so when students present with these difficulties, certainly we want to meet them with great compassion and understanding, and we want to try to understand their story and how they got to this point, and we want to support the families and so forth. But there are certain things that we can't do in terms of referring to a male student as a female and making accommodations with bathrooms and things like this. And it's very difficult to navigate all of this. And many schools, many Catholic schools, are completely unprepared because they don't have clear policies. They don't have a clear stance on gender. They don't. Many of our Catholic school teachers haven't been told what our Catholic church teaches on this matter.
Right. Right.
Which is part of the reason why, one of the central reasons why we're hosting trainings this summer. We do this each summer, and this year we've decided to do it twice because the need is so great, where we have a three-day immersion course in theology of the body for teachers. That's going to be offered in June, and it's going to be offered again in August. And then that's followed up with a two-day training specifically on this issue of gender. And we're going to have experts from a number of different fields, medicine, endocrinology, psychology, law, and education, where we're going to be looking at this and how Catholic schools and Catholic parishes should respond to these kinds of very difficult situations and how to be prepared for them so that we can respond in a pastoral, caring way, but in a way that's also authentically Catholic, true to our faith, and ultimately loving, because you can't be loving if you're not based in truth.
Right. Now, Vera Woods Press has actually produced material, theology of the body material, for grammar school as well as older.
Yes.
That's really pioneering work that you've been doing. Tell us a little bit about the materials themselves.
Sure. So we have been developing a Theology of the Body curriculum. We call it Rooted, Theology of the Body K-12 curriculum. So it goes all the way through, from kindergarten all the way up. And basically the purpose of this curriculum, this is not a sex ed curriculum. It's meant to teach young people what it means to be human in the light of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start with kindergartners, teaching them about some of the themes from Theology of the Body. What does it mean to be a human person, created in God's image and likeness? And the early grades are beautiful because they're story-based. So it involves reading stories, discussing the stories with the children, and guiding them through some activities based on some of the Theology of the Body themes extracted from the stories. So it's a very gentle, sort of natural process of learning. There's some inspiration here from Montessori-style education, and it's very beautifully done. The books, the materials are beautiful, and the whole methodology is beautiful.
Yes, I've seen them. They are just exceptional. A great deal of effort went into these. Now, where do they begin? I mean, how far back do you go in a child's life?
Well, our materials start with kindergartners. We've talked about and have some consideration about even preparing some materials for pre-K.
Okay.
Because honestly, we have to get ahead of this, right? We have to get ahead of what these kids are being exposed to on the internet, on television, just in you know, life, community life around them. We have to start laying a foundation as early as we can in an age-appropriate way. Learning things like, you know, God made me good. I have a body and a soul. He makes us male and female, helping them cultivate a sense of wonder at creation, wonder at you know, their own, the creation of their own personhood, and developing a right understanding of what it means to be human, made in God's image and likeness.
How can people get in touch with you about the upcoming seminars?
Yeah, so the best way is to go to ruahwoodspress.com. That's R-U-A-H, woodspress.com. Click on the training tab. All the information is there. Should be two wonderful seminars in June and in August.
We'll talk again soon. Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome. Take care.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Being a new mom is hard work, but you don't have to choose between caring for your baby and caring for yourself. Remember, a peaceful mom is a better mom. Make sure to sleep when baby sleeps and be confident expecting your husband's help with both baby care and the household. No, he can't do everything either, but by being honest, you can work together to make a plan that helps you achieve better balance. Just remember, always prioritize your and your baby's well-being before housework and chores. In time, I promise you'll get on top of things, but only if you can focus on keeping your wits about you until you do. For tons of tips on balancing baby and self-care, check out Then Comes Baby, the Catholic Guide to Surviving and Thriving in the First 3 Years of Parenthood. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Are you passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him? Is that true? It's not true for most people in the church. Is Jesus my best friend? Is he your best friend? I'm looking around the church. There's a set of guys in here who have great man caves. As I was praying this morning, I felt like the Lord said, hey, when are you going to come to my man cave? Like, you guys think a flat screen TV is really cool. Well, you should see what I got to offer. Because I and I alone, he says, can really give you what it is you're longing for. Whoever it is we're rooting for right now, they're going to lose eventually. Or whatever it is that's occupying our time, one day we're going to realize it really wasn't that important. Why aren't we hanging out with the one who alone can show us what life is really all about? When was the last time you hung out in the Lord's man cave?
I worked in pro baseball for a long time, and we play on Sundays. And it was an easy excuse. I took the easy out and just didn't go to Mass. Got caught up in that whole selfishness, that whole, you know, I can do it all. The times when I was struggling were the times I needed God the most. And now that I've come back and accepted God, my world has completely changed.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
This month, you can bless Catholic mothers struggling to care for their families in developing countries. They spend hours collecting drinking water from rivers and often unsafe sources. With your support, Cross Catholic Outreach provides these women and their children with access to clean, safe water. Lift the poor's burdens, protect their health, and restore their hope. Call Cross Catholic Outreach at 888-766-2426 or visit crosscatholic.org/Ave Maria.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. In my book, Dangerous to the Faith, I spend about two chapters looking over a movement which goes by the name transhumanist movement. There's people debate what the proper term is for it, but transhumanism, and what it is we're going to talk about it over the next segment here, but as I understand it, it's a movement which believes, a movement of thinkers who believe that the evolutionary process has become conscious of itself for the first time, and that our future will be defined not necessarily by biological evolution, but by technological evolution. And in some way, you hear people talk, Ray Kurzweil talks about this, the emerging of technology and the human person. In fact, there's something called the 2045 Initiative, which strikes me as a little over the top, but I want you to just listen to some of the language here.
Find ways to transfer one's personality to an artificial carrier. Yet what we need is not just another technological revolution, but a new civilizational paradigm. We need new philosophy and ideology, new ethics, new culture and new psychology, and even new metaphysics. We must reset our limits, go beyond ourselves, beyond the Earth, and beyond the solar system. This is an adequate response to the challenges of our time. Thus, new reality and future man will arise.
And let's take a look, a little bit of the movement that underlies that kind of expression. With me is Dr. Jacob Schatzer. He has received his doctorate from Marquette University and is assistant professor and associate dean in the School of Theology and Missions at Union University. He is an ordained Southern Baptist minister and the author of a few books, including Transhumanism and the Image of God. And Dr. Schatzer, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's talk over transhumanism. What is it? Is it different than posthumanism?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so these two terms, I think, are related. And as you said earlier, you know, transhumanism basically is this broad movement with lots of different people in it, some of whom disagree with each other on details.
Right.
But in general, they're saying, this is our chance to take control of evolution and move humanity beyond its current limitations using whatever means necessary and available. So transhumanists are very focused on this process, whereas posthumanism, on the other hand, usually is talking about the result of that process. Now, there's overlap there and relation, but that tends to be the cleanest way kind of to divide those two terms.
Okay.
Transhumanists focus on the process. Posthumanists focus on the destination.
Are we in the transhumanist era?
Yeah, I mean, I think so in some ways, in that the things that are available to humans are more and more, you know, merging with what was previously called science fiction. And
right.
So in some sense, I think we are in the transhumanist era in the sense that there are a lot of options of things that we might use to better ourselves, whether or not that will change us from being human to being something post-human, I think, is another question. But we're certainly in an era when there are a lot of options that people are pursuing for these sorts of ends.
Years ago, I interviewed Ray Kurzweil. This is before the word transhumanism was being used. This goes back probably 25 years. And I remember in my conversation with him at the time, it was a book he had done on artificial intelligence and was not a topic I was especially interested in at the time, so it wasn't one of my best moments. But I asked him, I said, well, the way you're talking, it looks as though there's no, I guess, what you would call spirituality in such a world. And he immediately reacted by saying, what are you talking about? Of course there's spirituality. And he tried to make some claim that nothing human would be lost in this new development of artificial intelligence. What is spirituality within a transhumanist framework?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, for many transhumanists, I think that they would limit themselves to a very materialistic account
yeah.
of what it means to be human. And so anything that would fall under the name spirituality would be something that would be able to be explained through psychological processes, neurological processes, things like that. And so they might use the label spirituality to refer to that religious impulse that they would explain materialistically. But I don't think that there doesn't tend to be much room. Again, there's a lot of variety, but the mainstream transhumanism, if you will, doesn't have space for spirituality in the sense of a spirit created by God through which we can have relationship with God, those sorts of things.
It was a while back, but Francis Fukuyama was asked to write on what he thought. Foreign Policy magazine, in fact, did this. What's the most dangerous future? And Fukuyama said at the time, transhumanism, he said, it's an essentially idolatrous religion for offering a counterfeit salvation, a strange liberation movement that wants nothing less than to liberate the human race from its biological constraints. The goal is that humans must wrest their biological destiny from evolution's blind process of random variation and adaptation and move to the next stage as a species. Now, that's a while back. Are transhumanists talking like that? We're going to develop a new species?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, some of that language will still come up in the sense of, you know, there's not much agreement on what exactly we will be when we move beyond being human,
right.
You know, what we would call that. And there's also a great variety in the types of things that transhumanists are pursuing and using, everything from, you know, altering the body through merging it with machines to using pharmaceuticals, you know, to change the way the body operates or overcome limitations to become something more than human by taking control of those processes that we weren't previously able to control. So I think that language is still common, but there's certainly no agreement on what exactly that species would be, how you would define it or characterize
right.
it at all.
Yeah, this is what gets strange about it, because there's no, I mean, there's no, I don't, is there any teleology here? I mean, is there any, in other words, we talk about human potential, and normally when people say that, they're thinking in terms of some optimal future for the human,
yeah.
that is in some way, we're becoming all that we were created to be, something like that. But in the transhumanist idea of the future, there is no prescribed fulfillment, right? I mean, you're basically making it up as you go along.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only thing that we might be able to say is teleological in a sense is just the desire to overcome limitations.
Yeah, okay.
So the goal is to overcome limitations. Well, what are limitations? Well, whatever someone wants to call a limitation. And so there's no sense of this is what optimal is. It is left purely to be defined by the individual. And that's why many transhumanists don't come forward with a plan, hey, this is what everybody needs to do, this is what we need to pursue, but rather they focus on the removal of any prohibition so that people are able to do whatever they individually choose to do.
That's especially intriguing in light of the biblical narrative, isn't it? Given that the first test of the human had to do with limitations.
Yeah.
And so from a Christian point of view, this sounds like it might be a new form of spiritual warfare that we're facing.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, one of the things that I didn't touch on a lot in my book is Christian transhumanism. And especially at the time when I was researching and writing, for the most part, any Christian voices related to transhumanism were more fringe voices.
Right.
But now in the past year, 2 years, there's a growing a group, a Christian Transhumanist Association that has conferences and is trying to develop a more Christian version of what transhumanism would be. And basically, they want to still acknowledge some of these things that we see in the biblical narrative, but say, hey, transhumanism is our way to overcome sin and overcome the fall and things like that. And it's often connected also to kind of a post-millennial bring in the kingdom of God
mm-hmm.
through our work
okay.
type of worldview. And so it's definitely, there are thinkers who are trying to be more explicitly Christian in their transhumanism now, but that's still in the very the earlier stages of that, and is often connected to some less common beliefs and approaches.
Okay. I guess we are all, just in my lifetime, we have, especially with information technology, we've really attached our smartphones have become almost prosthetic devices. They kind of double as a memory or a search service that we have with us. And so we are using everyday technologies that are changing the way we think about the future, what's possible in the future. What is the link between everyday technology consumption and transhumanism?
Yeah, that's actually the angle that I really try to hit in the book, is that for the most part, I think most Christians still would say they're not interested in transhumanism.
Right.
They don't want that kind of future. But I think the way that we're using our technology, our everyday technology, is actually shaping us and teaching us to value the very things that transhumanists value, the very convenience, the overcoming of limitations, the desire for the new and the better. These are subtly changing us to actually be more accepting of what transhumanists are after. And so I think that this is especially the case with the smartphone, which I return to repeatedly because we so many people use them so much.
Right.
And so it's easy to say, oh, a tool is just a tool. A hammer is a hammer, but, you know, folks are not just carrying hammers around a lot more. They're living their whole life through the hammer, with digital technology and smartphones. And so because of the amount of time that we are spending glued to these devices doing various things, the formation that we're receiving, the discipling that we're receiving through them and through just the very nature of how they work is quite profound.
Yeah. Do you think there's sufficient conversation going on within Christian circles that is trying to look at the unintended consequences of these new technologies and how they might impact us spiritually?
Yeah, I think that there's more. I think that there's more, but I still think that Christians, for the most part, at least in the circles that I'm connected to, still kind of treat technology like, okay, there are obvious good things we can do with it and obvious bad things that we shouldn't do with it. And as long as we observe that, we're going to be okay. But what that doesn't take into account is that even sometimes doing good things, like maybe reading Bible verses on a smartphone or something that we would say, oh, that's good. But that's still shaping us in a bad way. It's changing the way we pay attention to God's word and to God and things like that. So I think that Christians are still not thinking enough about how even the good things we might do with our technology is having a counterformation that we might actually need to resist.
Well, Dr. Schatzer holds there. We'll come back and continue conversation, taking a look at transhumanism and the image of God. I'm Al Cresta.
The EWTN home video highlight for May is the story of Father John Sullivan. A Protestant born into a life of privilege, he left everything to follow God's call to become a Catholic priest and serve the poor and afflicted. And the faithful were blessed with countless miracles. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or call 1-800-854-6316.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic healthcare ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Join today's discussion and engage with producers on the Ave Maria Radio Facebook and Twitter accounts at Ave Maria Radio. Respond to interviews and learn who's coming up on Crest in the Afternoon, Catholic Connection, and other Ave Maria Radio programs. Make it easier by downloading the Ave Maria app on your smart devices. Then just tap on the Facebook and Twitter icons to get plugged in on the things that matter most. That's the Ave Maria Radio app or at Ave Maria Radio. Build the church. Bless the nations.
from God. Father Mitch Pacwa shares his experience.
I certainly had a bit of opposition. My father wasn't pleased with this at all, and he kept arguing with me. Once when I was 12, he said to me, "What do you want to be a priest for? Why don't you be a doctor? You don't have to be a priest to help people. You can be a doctor and get married and have kids." And I said to him then, "Dad, if I was a doctor and I helped people get better, that would be very good. But later on, they're going to die anyway. So if I'm a priest and I hear somebody's confession and they go to heaven, that lasts forever. So that's better." And he didn't know what to say. And he continued to oppose the idea over the next years. Yet that didn't stop me. And even when he said, "I'm going to disinherit you if you become a priest." And on the day of my first Mass, he did. But as I also said to him then, he told me, "Okay, you're out of my will." I said, "Dad, I can't keep it anyway. It doesn't matter. I'm a Jesuit, and we can't keep the money, so it really doesn't affect me. The issue is I'm trying to follow what God, our Lord, is asking of me." And this has been where I have found the greatest joy, that doing what I believe through my own prayer and through reflection and thinking about it and moving from a little boy's idea of what a priest would be like all the way to now in my early 50s, you know, realizing that this is exactly what I think is going to please God the most. And that's what I want to do, to please God.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious-life.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Jacob Schatzer. He's the author of Transhumanism and the Image of God, looking at today's technology and the future of Christian discipleship. We're talking quite a bit about the transhumanist movement in the last segment, and also the unintended consequences of our use of technology. And I want to pick up on where you left it last segment, Dr. Schatzer, and that is, Christians are always very concerned about the content of technology. And let me just go back to an old technology, television, or movies. So there's always a great deal of discussion about the kind of movies one might watch, how much sex, how much violence, how much negative view of the world are in these movies. But Christians generally don't ask themselves the question of, how is my understanding of reality being shaped by simply sitting in front of a screen X number of hours a day? And I think that's what you're trying to force us to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's where, you know, more attention needs to be paid. And we need to be willing to think about things that we think we like and we think are okay, but might be shaping us. And part of the problem is this is really a new thing, right? Smartphones being as prevalent as they are is really something that you look at a past decade or so.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the things that we need to know, how does this change us, even from a sociological perspective or a neurological perspective, it's going to rely on longitudinal studies that take a long time.
Right.
And so I think, you know, we're beginning to see some of the early results of that, and the results are, hey, this is changing us a lot. But we're going to have to wait for more studies to come out, and many of those will be many years down the road. One of the authors that I read, I believe it was Mary Akin, who deals with these sorts of things, basically said, hey, you know, you're right. We do need to wait a lot longer to see what these effects are going to be, especially on our children. Early results are the effects are damaging.
Yeah.
If you want to risk your children and go ahead and wait years and years and years for the studies to come out, go right ahead. But maybe wisdom would tell us to be a little more cautious as we continue to wait to see more and more of what these devices are doing.
I think there was a book published just last year by Dr. Gene Twenge. I think it was called iGen.
Yeah.
Which looks over a lot of the current literature and the current studies, and she's quite concerned of the impact it's having on this post-millennial generation that's coming up now. Some, I guess, people are fighting over what they're going to be called, iGens or Gen Z or whatever. We always fight over what name is going to win out for each cohort or generation. Let me ask about artificial intelligence here, because what was it, 10 years ago, there was a big discussion about this, quote, singularity that Ray Kurzweil referred to. And then in looking it over, I found out he wasn't alone. There were many people who believe that in the relatively near future, there'll be a merging of natural intelligence and artificial intelligence. And at that time, as I remember, Kurzweil was saying that it has to happen, or artificial intelligence has all the possibility, as we see in science fiction stories, of actually taking over the world. Now, what is the talk about kind of merging natural intelligence with artificial intelligence? I'm talking about uploading consciousness.
Yeah. So this is one of the more still sci-fi elements of this whole discussion that folks are not sure what it would look like. We can all think of movies where we've seen something like this happening, right? But experts still are not sure what the best route for that is, or if it's even possible. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, it's because many people think of the human brain as an information storer, and so we think, well, computers can store information, so
right.
If we can get all the information from a particular human brain onto a computer, then we've just uploaded the consciousness. Well, actually, you've just duplicated the contents of a brain, and then that, even if you could do that, you would still have a human person with all of those experiences and memories and information, and then a computer with the same, and so that doesn't mean that person doesn't then live inside the computer and no longer live in the human body. And so how this mind uploading would actually happen and not just be a mind cloning or a downloading of information is still very much up in the air. But it's tied to this notion, like you said, of the singularity, which is the idea essentially that artificial intelligence will reach a point where it's self-aware and self-propagating and will just grow at such a speed that it takes over. And so we had better learn to merge with it before that happens, or,
right.
or we're going to be left behind. I think that relies on a lot. I'm not a scientist or a technologist, so I don't want to overspeak, but from my exposure to that, I think that relies a lot on some assumptions that artificial intelligence will develop in the same way that other computer technology has, doubling processor speed, for instance, quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And we just haven't seen AI having that track record.
Right.
In fact, artificial intelligence went through what many experts call an AI winter for a couple decades, where there wasn't much progress made until some fundamental assumptions of the field were changed, and now we're seeing growth again. And there's nothing to say that growth will continue at the same rate. We very well could hit another AI winter where it kind of stays the same for a while. So I think it's certainly something we need to think about as we engage with technology, but I don't think it's to the point where we need to realistically fear it yet or plan how we're going to upload our consciousness into a computer to get around it.
You spend a lot of time in the book taking a look at how use of new technologies change our sense of place, our nature of relationship, our sense of self. And we're talking about the extreme instance here of artificial intelligence and mind uploading. But how does the use and dependence, and I have to say, I am surrounded by these information technologies. I have to make an effort to keep myself active away from them, because I find the rich resources that they offer me really enchanting. How do they change our sense of place?
Yeah, so I think that these technologies change just our interaction with reality, we can say, simply because they become a device that we are going to report to or experience reality through. And so often it changes a sense of place, because I'm sure you've been in a place before where all the other people in the place are all on their digital device.
Yep.
It changes what's going on there, what the place is.
And what is the reality that we're all experiencing?
Yeah, and the ability to, no matter where you are, to leave that place and, for all intents and purposes, enter the world of your phone, teaches you to value certain things. It teaches you to value the convenience of information gathering rather than the difficulty of inhabiting a place with real people. I think that our technology just provides us with the opportunity to flee from the inconvenient, to flee from the difficult. And sometimes it's the inconvenient and the difficult that make us who we are and give our places the charm that they have and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So our attention withdraws from our external surroundings. Are we less likely to decorate our homes or our rooms because that's so secondary to our being embedded in our information technologies?
You know, I haven't thought much about that angle of it, but I think that that would be the type of thing that someone could do a really interesting study on. You know, how did teenagers decorate their rooms in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and how did teenagers decorate their rooms now, and what does that say about the way that place serves for them as a home or as a refuge? So I'm not aware. I could make assumptions or guesses, but I think it's a really great question.
Yeah, I mean, in the 1960s, when I was in high school, the way you decorated your room was a way of basically declaring who you were. You know, the posters you'd put on the wall, the way you'd paint, and odd objects you might collect there. And I wonder, too, if teenagers today still spend a lot of time thinking about their room in the same way, or are they basically decking out their Facebook page?
Yeah.
I don't know. Talk about changing notions of self as well. And this is especially important for those of us who believe we're made to image God and made in his image, and who believe that we are, in fact, on a path of learning, a path of discipleship, in which we will be conformed to Christ. How does this new, I mean, this is fairly new in the history of discipleship to have this kind of technology. How does it affect our walk with Christ?
Yeah, well, I think on the one hand, we always have had, just as humans, this desire to project ourselves in relation to others, right? Even our discussion we were just having about bedrooms, you know, you mentioned that it was a way of stating your identity, of locating yourself somewhere with objects and with things that were connected to you. So at one level, it's not a new thing, but the problem is the possibilities and the just the way that it's always right in front of young people, this need to project themselves in social media, this need to pursue relationships by shaping themselves in a certain way, and just the way that it teaches you to think of yourself as this individual with limitless choices of who you want to be and how you want to project yourself forward. And while there certainly is individualism in being human and being in the image of God, the hope of Christianity is not that God will just help us figure out who we want to project ourselves as and just encourage us and clap for us as we go along, but rather that he is making us into the image of his Son.
Right.
The hope for Christians is not really a unique self-identity. Rather, it's a union with Christ,
right,
as the New Testament
right.
speaks about it.
Yes. Yes, and in that sense, that is the change, above all changes, that we're striving for in this ever-changing world of technology can be, in some ways, a distraction to us. It gives us the impression that the real change is taking place external to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think distraction is a key word there. It's one that we often use, we often sense, but we forget that attention is so important. You know, attention isn't just what's in your circle of vision, but attention in that deep sense of attending to, of focusing on. And we find ourselves so distracted that we can't pay attention to anything, let alone to God, to his word, and to his work in shaping us into the image of Christ.
Well, Dr. Schatzer, thank you. Great talking with you. I think the book's remarkable, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jacob Schatzer, Transhumanism and the Image of God.
The arguments raging in today's society as to the state of marriage and who may enter into it shouldn't cause us to forget its permanent characteristics. According to the Catholic Catechism, the matrimonial covenant has two main purposes: the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. Our Lord Jesus raised this covenant to the dignity of a sacrament. The Catechism also reminds us of the indisputable fact that marriage is not a purely human institution. God himself is the author of marriage, and only God, not man, can change its common and permanent characteristics. It began with the creation of man and woman in the image and likeness of God, who is love. Thus, their mutual and unfailing love becomes an image of the absolute and unfailing love with which God loves man. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory, somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Well, thank you so much. By all means, get to the website at AveMariaRadio.net and follow up. We have Jacob Schatzer's book there. We'll also have my own book, Dangers to the Faith, which has two chapters dealing with transhumanism and evolutionism that I think do a good job of summarizing the present dilemma. You can also get more information on the theology of the body for children at Ruha Woods Press. Again, we'll have all the contact information for you in the Crested Guest Archives, including more information on Cardinal Joseph Menzenti, and also a quick fix for a bad mood, as we learned about it with Dr. Gregory Popcheck. Now, stay tuned, because Catholic Answers Live follows me, where there's going to be a great Q&A forum with Colin Donovan and Tim Staples. And tonight, it's Mother Angelica Live Classics. Tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon, Dr. Bill Kurtz will be with us, looking at Catholics during the Civil War and how the Civil War actually had an important role in shaping American Catholicism. We'll also be talking with the literary biographer Joseph Pierce about John Henry Cardinal Newman and the expected canonization of the man, and Father Dwight Longnecker with me, looking at John Allen's work in Future Church. It's been 10 years since the book was published. How did John do in predicting the future? So, again, join me tomorrow. We've got two more hours to talk about the things that matter most. And let me again encourage you to join Steve Ray and myself in our trip to Poland coming up at the end of August. It's going to be a great time where we visit the sites associated with St. John Paul II, St. Maximilian Kolbe, St. Faustina, and there'll be great time of learning, a great time of devotion, and a great time of fellowship. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net for more information. I'll see you tomorrow.
Preston in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.